Title of a talk is a question. Title of a talk or a paper is a question. The answer is always no. However, I just finished writing the paper on this last week, and the title of the paper I wrote was, "Is a time-symmetric interpretation of quantum theory possible without retrocausality?" So if you answer no to both those questions, then you're in a contradiction. So I will leave it to you at the end of this talk to make up your mind which one of those I mean. All right. Well, let's start very simply. So many people would say that the collapse of the wave function shows that there's some kind of fundamental time asymmetry in quantum theory. Now, of course, we all know from the two-state vector formalism that you can make the predictions of quantum theory look perfectly time symmetric. Okay, but in order to do that, what Yakir had to do was introduce, in addition to the usual forwards evolving quantum state, a backwards evolving quantum state that comes from the future, and of course depends on what your future choice of measurement setting is going to be. So that seems like, if you take it at face value, it seems like some kind of a retrocausality, some kind of an influence backwards in time. So does that mean that we have to accept that there's a retrocausality in nature if you want to have time symmetry? Okay, so phrased in that way, the answer to the question is definitely no, because it all depends, of course, on how you interpret these objects that appear in the quantum formalism. In particular, what is the meaning of these quantum states? So let me just run through a very simple argument, which I'm sure you're all familiar with, I prepared earlier. So suppose you have two polarizers oriented at different angles. So the usual story in the usual quantum formalism is that when the photon passes through this polarizer, it has a quantum state oriented parallel to this polarizer, which propagates forwards in time like this, and then we have a probability for passing the second polarizer. So if you think that that quantum state represents a state of physical reality, i.e. if you think it's something like a real physical field or something like that, then you have to say that if I played the video of that experiment backwards in time, then what exists in reality, this thing exists in reality. So what happens is that over here, the system starts off in this state, so it somehow seems to have a premonition of what this polarizer orientation is going to be, and then it evolves backwards in time. So that's a time asymmetry. In that case, if the quantum state, if you think it's really real, then you can very easily argue that in order to restore time symmetry, I'm going to have to introduce this quantum state on an equal footing. Now this particular argument, this is a very, very simplified, non-rigorous version of that argument, but Hugh Price has made an argument like this, where one of the assumptions is that the quantum state is a state of reality. However, if you don't believe that, if you believe that quantum states represent something like knowledge or information, then you'll say to me, Matt, you are being completely stupid. The reason why we assign this quantum state over here is because when we're evolving forwards in time is because we know the orientation of this polarizer. We've seen the photons pass through this polarizer, so we use our knowledge of that orientation to say that in order to make predictions in the future, I should assign a state aligned with this. When I run the experiment backwards in time, you know that the photon has passed through this polarizer. So the quantum state that you ought to assign is this one, and you ought to evolve that backwards in time in the usual way. Now, because we have a time symmetry of probabilities in quantum theory, so because these two things are equal, it won't matter which one of those two descriptions I choose, right? So you can say that, you know, if you don't believe this thing is a real physical field, then quantum theory was already perfectly time symmetric to begin with. What the ABL rule shows here is this is the way that you can take into account information about both future and past if you happen to know it. Okay, but it wasn't really needed to have a time-symmetric fundamental ontology. Okay, so in the face of that, the question is, well, now the question is open, right? It could still be the case that we do need to have some retrocausality in nature, but we'll need a different argument, one that doesn't assume anything about what kinds of things exist in reality. That's exactly why I turned off the Wi-Fi, but that didn't work. Okay. So the question is, can we come up with such an argument? And I should say here that Hugh Price's argument was the inspiration for this. But what we're trying to do here is prove a theorem that's at the same kind of level of generality as Bell's theorem. So what we're trying to say is, given a set of experimental predictions, not necessarily the quantum ones, do they admit a time-symmetric, non-retrocausal ontology or not? Okay, so I'm going to have to talk in a sort of bit more abstraction about what's the class of operational experiments, what's the sort of operational counterpart of this specific kind of time symmetry in quantum theory, and then how are we going to try and model that in terms of things that might exist in reality. Okay, so first of all, we need to talk about just what we observe in the lab, the operational framework. So we're going to take a very simple class of experiments, which just consists of some preparation device over here, followed by some transformation, which just represents the possible dynamics of your system between preparation and measurement, followed by a measurement, these three things happening in a definite time order. So both the preparation device and the measurement device are going to have inputs and outputs. Okay, so for the measurement device, you're probably fairly familiar with this kind of idea. This represents the setting of the measurement device. This represents the measurement outcome. But for the preparation device, of course, we can, in principle, control everything about the preparation, but we don't have to. We can imagine that this is some setting of the preparation device, and the preparation process itself might involve generating some randomness. There might be somebody sitting in a box here, depending on what X is here, they might flip a coin with different biases and choose what state to prepare and then output the value of the coin, right? So a preparation procedure can have outputs as well as inputs. Okay, so what I mean by an operational theory is we're going to specify a set of possible experiments. So these are preparation, transformation, and measurement devices that can be connected together. And for each such experiment, the theory must produce a prediction. Okay, so the conditional probabilities of what the two outputs will be given the inputs. Although it doesn't have to be quantum theory, here's how you would model something like that in quantum theory. So a preparation procedure is going to be associated with the Hilbert space of the quantum system, and I'm going to model the possible outputs of that by a set of subnormalized density operators. So what this means is that for every choice of X, there is a set of probabilities, a set of density operators labeled by A. The trace of those represent the probability with which that preparation occurs. And then if outcome A occurs, then this is the density operator that gets spat out. Transformation, as usual, it could be unitary dynamics or whatever you like, but you know, in general, we just model that by a trace preserving completely positive map. It's sort of the most general thing if you allow decoherence and things like that to be acting. And our measurement device is, again, going to be associated with Hilbert space. And now we're going to have, in general, a set of positive operator value measures. They could be observables or projective measures if you prefer using those. Okay, so what that means is that for every choice Y here, there's a set of operators labeled by B. They have to form a positive operator value measure. Okay, so what I mean by an experiment is, well, these three things can only be connected together in an experiment if the Hilbert space is matched. So the Hilbert space of the preparation has to be the same as the input space for the transformation, and the output space of the transformation has to be the same as the Hilbert space for the measurement. Then I can hook those things up into a single experiment, and then I can just use the Born rule. The conventional Born rule gives me what the quantum predictions are for that experiment. So that's just to show you that these kinds of quantum experiments fit in here. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about time symmetry on the operational level. So this is on the level of the observed statistics. So we say that an experiment has an operational time reverse if there's another experiment consisting of another preparation, another transformation, another measurement, where, first of all, I require that the labels of the inputs and outputs of this measurement are the same as the labels and the inputs and outputs of this preparation, and vice versa. And furthermore, the probability distributions are the same. Okay, so the idea here is that if somebody comes to you with a list, you know, they've performed this one of these two experiments many, many, many times, and they come to you with a list of X, A, Y, and B, right, for each run of the experiment. Question is, can you tell whether that was an experiment that was this experiment running forwards in time or that experiment running backwards in time? And if you have this operational time symmetry, then you won't be able to tell a difference. Okay, now we'll say that a theory is operationally time symmetric if every experiment in the theory has an operational time reverse. Now, of course, this is a very, very problematic thing to do because operational theories aren't usually time symmetric in this sense. The reason being, it's possible for me to send a signal into the future, but not into the past. So generally, the predictions of your operational theory will satisfy this, which means that from the output of the preparation, I shouldn't be able to tell anything about the future measurement setting. Like quantum theory satisfies that, you'd expect any theory to satisfy that. But you wouldn't necessarily expect this to hold, right? There's no good reason why the output of your measurement can't tell you something about what the input of the preparation was. Okay, so that won't hold in general, but given any, okay, but first of all, let me make some comments about this. So what I believe about this is that this doesn't represent anything like a fundamental time asymmetry in nature. Why do we have this kind of asymmetry? It's because when you're giving an operational description of an experiment, that necessarily means an description from the point of view of the experimenter. Okay, that's what operational means. And experimenters have subjective arrays of time, right? An experimenter seems to be able to remember the past and not the future. They seem to be able to partially control the future, but not the past. And we think that the reason why we have a subjective arrow of time is the same as the reason why we have a thermodynamic arrow of time, right? Those two things are necessarily aligned. So this asymmetry here just represents the effect of the subjective arrow of time. And if we want to get at what are the operational time symmetries of our theory, we want to factor that out somehow. Now, one thing you could do is allow yourself to do post-selections for free. That would symmetrize things again, at least in the case of quantum theory. But for the purposes of this argument, we can do something much simpler, which is to just say, well, hey, there's nothing stopping us just looking at the experiments, right? There's a class of experiments in the theory which happen to satisfy both no signaling conditions, okay? So if we restrict attention to that class of experiments, that's what I'm going to call the no signaling sector of a theory. There's no reason, by the way, that the no signaling sector of a theory in general has to be operationally time symmetric. You can easily come up with examples where that's not the case. However, it is true in quantum theory. So in quantum theory, no signaling preparations correspond to having this condition. So the point is that the ensemble average density operator can't depend on what your choice of input was. So when you average over the output, you must get the same state. Otherwise, there'll be a measurement which could give you some information about what that input was. Okay, so that means we're restricting attention to preparations, which are ensemble decompositions of a common density operator. So if you have that requirement, then you can show that the no signaling sector of quantum theory is operationally time symmetric. To do that, you have to define the operational time reverse of any experiment. Here are some equations which do that. I'm not going to go through it in any great detail. This comes from some work that I did with Rob Speckens a few years ago. And you can think of these things as quantum analogs of Bayes' rule in various circumstances. But I'm not going to go through any of the proof now, just you can read this paper if you want to find out why that's true. So that's an operational time symmetry that quantum theory happens to have, and it's non-trivial because not every theory has to have it. Okay, so that was, so far we've just been talking about what you can observe in the lab. Now let's try to talk about reality. Okay, so now what we want to do is assume that in actual fact the system has some real physical ontological properties between the time of the preparation and the measurement. And we're just going to call those properties lambda following John Bell, right? So we're not assuming anything about what those are. We're not assuming that they are quantum states. We're not assuming that they're not quantum states. We're not, they could be any mathematical object you like that represents whatever it is that exists in reality. Okay, so all I want to say at this point is that, well, you would expect the properties of your physical system to be correlated somehow with the degrees of freedom that you actually observe. So what that means is that we should have a joint distribution over the operational variables and also lambda. Okay, so if this is going to be able to be empirically adequate, we should give you the same predictions as the operational theory. So when I marginalize over lambda, I should get back the probabilities that I had just for the operational variables before. Now I'm going to call this thing, so if I write down one of these for an experiment, I'm going to call it an ontic extension of the experiment. And an ontic extension of a theory is just an assignment of such a distribution to every experiment in the theory. Okay? Right, so now we can play the same game at the ontological level as we were playing at the operational level. So I can define an ontological time reverse in the same sort of way as I did in the operational case, except now I demand that the probability distributions match when I also include lambda. Okay, so anybody who's still awake at this point should be objecting immediately to this definition, because we all know that when you take a time reverse, you have to do all sorts of funny things, such as, for example, classically, if you have a phase space trajectory, you have to reverse the sign of the momentum, or if you take a quantum state, you have to take its complex conjugate, or whatever. So you would expect there to be a similar kind of transformation of lambda that happens when you take a time reverse. And you can take that into account, right? So all that matters is that so long as that map is a bijection, as long as it's a one-to-one map, everything I'm about to say will go through. It just complicates the argument somewhat, so I'm just going to simplify it and assume that it's the same lambda in both cases. But if you read the paper, there's an argument for why that doesn't matter. Okay. So now I can say that an ontic extension is ontologically time symmetric if every experiment has an ontological time reverse. In particular, that's just it. Okay, so those were just sort of definitions. Now we want to make some assumptions about other things that our ontic extensions should obey that will enable us to prove a theorem. Okay, so the first one is the most important one. This is what we mean in this context by time symmetry. What we want to do is make what we call time symmetry assumption, which says that if a theory happens to be operationally time symmetric, so an example of a theory that's operationally time symmetric is the no signaling sector of quantum theory, then we say it should have an ontic extension that's ontologically time symmetric. So we take these observed probabilities being symmetric as evidence that we should have a fundamental asymmetry. So why do we do that? Well, if this holds, then we can say that the explanation for that time symmetry is that it's a fundamental physical principle. It holds for reality, right? So if we say that's a fundamentally physical principle, then the fact that we have this will explain why we have this. On the other hand, if this holds but this doesn't, then there has to be some sort of fine-tuning in the probabilities which prevents you from seeing the asymmetry that actually exists at the ontological level. So this is a kind of principle that's in line with the sorts of things that Rob Speckens talks about in terms of contextuality, non-contextuality principles. Okay, so now we need to, well, what we really need is just one more assumption for our argument, which is this one, but I will talk about a couple of other assumptions as well. So this is our no retrocausality assumption. All I'm really assuming here is that, well, X and Y, the inputs are basically free choices. And what that means is I'm just going to write be able to write all probabilities conditional on those. So assume that you could generate any probabilities for the inputs that you like. And then further, we're going to assume that everything's that variables are conditionally independent of what's in their future given their past. Okay, so what it means is I'm going to have a decomposition of the probabilities in this experiment like this, where things only depend on variables that are in their past. Okay, so this diagram here, for those of you who are familiar with this, this is an influence diagram, or it's kind of a generalized Bayesian network. And this condition says that we have to have satisfy the causal Markov condition with respect to that. If you don't know what any of that means, the assumption is just we have this decomposition. Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk about two other assumptions, which in the end we won't necessarily need, but it's useful to get a comparison with Bell's theorem. So here's an assumption that I personally think is well justified. It's a slightly stronger assumption, which I call lambda mediation. So this means that all of the correlations between the preparation and the measurement should be mediated by the ontic state of the system. And as far as I'm concerned, this is sort of just part of the definition of what we mean by properties of the system, right? We want the fact that we observe correlations between preparation and measurement to be explained by the fact that the system actually has some physical properties, and not by the fact that there's some other correlation mechanism, like a telephone wire going from our preparation device to our measurement device. If this doesn't hold, then it's very difficult to see how you can say that you're doing an experiment on the system as opposed to something else. So anyway, what this assumption means is that we just get rid of these two other possible mechanisms for correlation, and then we have a simpler decomposition, and this is equivalent to when Rob Speckens, for instance, introduced the concept of an ontological model. That means basically an ontic extension that satisfies this and this. Okay, so that's equivalent to that. Turns out, you don't really need such a strong assumption. We can get away with this as long as there isn't an arrow going here. I have absolutely no idea why you would want a model in which you have this causal connection but not that one, but just that's all we need for the theorem, so I'm mentioning it. Okay, how long do I have, by the way?
4 or 5 minutes.
Okay, good. So now I can get to the main result. So here's the main theorem. So first of all, if you have an ontic extension of an operationally time-symmetric experiment that satisfies our time symmetry and no retrocausality assumptions, then it must satisfy these three conditions. Now, anybody who's thought about Bell's theorem, these conditions should be immediately familiar, right? So bear in mind that at the moment we're talking about a time-like experiment, but if we imagined that we were actually talking about a space-like EPR experiment, right, then in that context, this is what's called the measurement independence condition, and these two conditions are what's called parameter independence. Okay, so that's what they are in the context of Bell's theorem, but here we're talking about them in the context of a time-like experiment, and we've derived them instead from these two assumptions. Then, if you also satisfy the weak lambda mediation assumption, you get to this. And it shouldn't be too surprising for people who know about Bell's theorem, because you know that in order to get to local causality, what you need to add to here is what's called the outcome independence condition, but that's just the condition that there isn't a direct cause from here to here. Okay. So first of all, again, this should be familiar to most people. In a time-like experiment, you can violate Bell inequalities, right? So this condition would imply the Bell inequalities, as usual. But we can violate those in a time-like experiment. It is important here, in contrast with things like Leggett-Garg, that remember our preparation has to be a no-signaling one. So we have to take care of that. But of course, you can do that if your two possible inputs are either prepare this ensemble decomposition of the maximally mixed state or that one, and then you make one of these two measurements, you'll violate the CHSH inequality to its maximum value of 2 square root of 2. Okay. Okay, I haven't got very much time. I wanted to explain a little bit about how these proofs work. Here's the proof of the sort of measurement independence condition. I'm not going to go through it in great detail. The way these things work is you write down the sort of decomposition that comes from your no retrocausality assumption, but then by applying the time symmetry assumption, you know that the operational time reverse experiment has to also have the same probabilities, and that has a decomposition in the opposite time order. So then what you do is you take those two decompositions and you compare the conditional independences that you can get from them together, and that's what gives you those kinds of conditions that we had. Okay, so the final thing I want to say is that we actually don't, so it was nice to get to Bell's theorem, but actually you don't really need it. You don't really need the lambda mediation assumptions. You can still prove something, right? Because the basic idea is if you don't have the lambda mediation, then all you get to from time symmetry and no retrocausality is these three conditions, so measurement independence and parameter independence. But then in the space-like context, we know in that context, there's something called the Kolbeck-Renner theorem. That shows that there's an experiment for which, well, you can have an ontic extension if you like, but in the time-like context, what their theorem shows is that for that experiment, you would have to satisfy this condition, which means that the outcome of your measurement can depend on some ontic variables. Basically, the point is, even if you know the ontic variable, this doesn't allow you to predict any more fine-grained probabilities than just knowing the operational degrees of freedom, right? So you don't, unlike in Bell's theorem, you don't rule out the possibility of these things entirely, but it's fairly pointless because this basically can't really have any causal influence on the measurement outcome. Okay, so that's pretty much it. I assume that there's going to be, if I had more time, I would spend time defending my assumptions. But since I don't, I'm sure that you're all going to object to them in question time anyway. So thanks.
Objections?
The question. So it seems to me that the assumption that warrants your time symmetry principle, the no fine tuning assumption,
yeah,
is strong enough to also justify your lambda mediation assumption. So, I mean, you suggested that, you know, one way to try to justify lambda mediation is just say, I define lambda as whatever thing mediates the causal influence from here to here. And you can do that, but then somebody might say, well, I think that there are some causal influences that just aren't mediated by anything. So then they would be thinking that there's another error. But if instead you say, look, you know, in my experiment, there's a spin that goes between the preparation and the measurement. And then I notice the following thing, that no matter how I do the preparation, whatever preparation I do, whatever measurement I do, if I intervene on that spin and I sort of, you know, do a measurement and then re-prepare independently, I can always screen off those correlations, mm-hmm, right? And so that tells me that there's something special about the spin. The spin allows me to screen off those correlations. And if there was actually some other route of causal influence, then I would have to fine-tune it such that I could explain the lack of correlations I see when I intervene on the spin. So I think you can actually get a two-for-one from no fine-tuning.
Okay. I mean, I accept that. I mean, I think lambda mediation is an extremely reasonable assumption. The only reason I'm making weaker assumptions is just because you can, and there are some people who will object to stronger ones. But I totally buy that argument, yeah. Everything's no fine-tuning.
Maybe I missed the point. You had a question. Can we have time-symmetric theory without retrocausality?
Mm-hmm.
Quantum mechanics.
Well, quantum mechanics, not quantum mechanics without interpretation, because quantum mechanics without interpretation doesn't say anything about
standard quantum mechanics. Von Neumann, this collapse. I don't forget about many words. This collapse.
No.
Quantum mechanics, this collapse.
No,
it's time symmetric, as Yakir showed, ABL for all kinds of things. You can look at it. Now, Schrödinger equation is time symmetric. And it's no retrocausality whatsoever. I don't know, it's just Q price and Q others, but there is no such thing there.
Well, the standard von Neumann formula is less collapsed, right? And if you say, well, my response to that is ABL, or ABL has state vector coming from the future, so retro causality. I then, but then that's the argument I gave.
This is retro causality.
So you have to define what causality means, of course, but as far as I'm concerned, like, there are, apparently in the world there are variables that we can control, and if controlling one of those things changes something in the past, then I'm going to call that retrocausality. Okay, I mean it's like the only real notion that makes sense, right? There are apparently there are some variables that we can control. Right, whether that free will is genuine or not doesn't really matter, but as an epistemic concept, it seems to make sense. If doing that changes something in the past, that's retrocausality as far as I'm concerned. So the fact that my future measurement choice changes what the backwards evolving state vector is, I'm going to call that retrocausality. You could say, as Yakir does, that's not really what's happening. It's like there's a destiny vector from the beginning of time, right? But you know, as far as I'm concerned, that's what I mean by retrocausality.
But then may I just add that in many worlds, what you would say?
Well, many worlds is an interesting
because
case.
Then here, I understand, in particular world, it's one story. Here,
yeah.
Yes.
So all of this assumes like single world realism, of course. Many worlds is an interesting case, because obviously it doesn't satisfy the assumptions of this theorem, so I can't say anything because of that, but it doesn't actually satisfy the kind of time symmetry I'm talking about here. Right? Remember, there's the usual physicist notion of dynamical time symmetry. Many worlds satisfies that, no problem. What we're talking about here is something slightly stronger than that. It's kind of like this sort of time symmetry or a generalization thereof. Right? I'm saying, there's a time symmetry of the probabilistic predictions, and therefore there should be an ontological one. Now let me explain. So my time symmetry assumption, like as in Hugh Price's argument, says that if I put a photon into, say, a polarizing beam splitter such that it comes out of one particular port, and then I later put another polarizing beam splitter and detect which outcome that has, which path I detect it on, then according to the operational time reverse conditions, that's the time reverse of, at this end, putting in along a definite input on this side, and then doing the same thing on this side. Now, that's not true in many worlds, because in many worlds, you have two branches coming out here. Okay, so this is a notion of time symmetry that things like many worlds and Bohm don't satisfy. Now, so you could say, well, I'm happy with the kind of time symmetry that we have in those theories, so I don't care about your time symmetry assumption. Right, that would be one possible response to this. But all I want to say,
time symmetry, you want just one. Otherwise, everything time symmetric. I put future world.
Well,
so is it then? I start with one, I get two. I start with two, I get one.
Sure, of course. But what I'm saying is that there's a time symmetry in the operational predictions, right, which exists there, just on the level of the probabilistic predictions of the theory, which isn't reflected by that particular theory. Now, you can say I don't like your time symmetry principle, therefore, that's a perfectly reasonable response to this. But I'm trying to argue that this is a kind of fine-tuning principle, like the kinds of similar to the kinds of things that Rob makes in other arguments. So.
All right. With that, let's think about it again.